bring to the party? What's so special about human beings? Our endlessly complex interactions with each other. We know what you're thinking. Big brains. True, but our unique brains result from our chatty sociability. Though debate rages concerning precisely why the human brain grew so large so quickly, most would agree with anthropologist Terence W. Deacon when he writes, "The human brain has been shaped by evolutionary processes that elaborated the capacities needed for language, and not just by a general demand for greater intelligence." In a classic feedback loop, our big brains both serve our need for complex, subtle communication and result from it. Language, in turn, enables our deepest, most human feature, the ability to form and maintain a flexible, multidimensional, adaptive social network. Before and beyond anything else, human beings are the most social of all creatures. We have another quality that is especially human, in addition to our disproportionately large brains and associated capacity for language. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it is also something woven into our all-important social fabric, our exaggerated sexuality. No animal spends more of its allotted time on Earth fussing over sex than Homo sapiens, not even the famously libidinous bonobo. Although we and the bonobo both average well into the hundreds, if not thousands, of acts of intercourse per birth, way ahead of any other primate, their acts are briefer than ours. Pair-bonded, monogamous animals are almost always hyposexual, having sex as the Vatican recommends, infrequently, quietly, and for reproduction only. Human beings, regardless of religion, are at the other end of the libidinal spectrum, hypersexuality personified. Human beings and bonobos use eroticism for pleasure, for solidifying friendship, and for cementing a deal. Recall that, historically, marriage is more akin to a corporate merger than a declaration of eternal love. For these two species, and apparently only these two species, non-reproductive sex is natural, a defining characteristic. Does all this frivolous sex make our species sound animalistic? It shouldn't. The animal world is full of species that have sex only during widely spaced intervals when the female is ovulating. Only two species can do it week in and week out for non-reproductive reasons. One human, the other very human-like. Sex for pleasure with various partners is therefore more human than animal. Strictly reproductive, once-in-a-blue-moon sex is more animal than human. In other words, an excessively horny monkey is acting human, while a man or woman uninterested in sex more than once or twice a year would be, strictly speaking, acting like an animal. Though many strive to hide their human libidinousness from themselves and each other, being a force of nature, it breaks through. Lots of upright, proper Americans were scandalized by the way Elvis moved his hips when he sang rock and roll. But how many realized what the phrase rock and roll meant? Cultural historian Michael Ventura, investigating the roots of African American music, found that rock and roll was a term that originated in the juke joints of the South. Long in use by the time Elvis appeared, Ventura explains the phrase hadn't meant the name of a music, it meant to fuck. Rock, by itself, had pretty much meant that in those circles since the 20s at least. By the mid-1950s, when the phrase was becoming widely used in mainstream culture, Ventura says the disc jockeys either didn't know what they were saying or were too sly to admit what they knew. Though crusty old Ed Sullivan would have been scandalized to realize what he was saying when he announced this new rock and roll all the kids are crazy about. Examples of barely concealed sexual reference lurking just below the surface of common American English don't stop there. Robert Ferris Thompson, America's most prominent historian of African art, says that funky is derived from the Kikongo, lufuki, meaning positive sweat, of the sort you get from dancing or having sex, but not working. One's mojo, which has to be working to attract a lover, is Kikongo for soul. Boogie comes from mboogie, meaning devilishly good. And both jazz and jism likely derive from dinza, the Kikongo word for to ejaculate. Forget the billions pouring in from porn. Forget all the TNA on TV, in advertising, and in movies. Forget the love songs we sing on the way into relationships and the blues on the way out. Even if we include none of that, the percentage of our lives we human beings spend thinking about, planning, having, and remembering sex is incomparably greater than that of any other creature on the planet. Despite our relatively low reproductive potential, few women have ever had more than a dozen or so children, our species truly can, and does, rock around the clock.
If I had had to choose my place of birth, I would have chosen a state in which everyone knew everyone else, so that neither the obscure tactics of vice nor the modesty of virtue could have escaped public scrutiny and judgment. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, 1754.
Rousseau was born in the wrong time, wrong place. If he'd been born in the same spot 20,000 years earlier, among the artists sketching life-sized bulls on European cave walls, he'd have known every member of his social world. Alternatively, born into his own era, but in one of the many societies not yet altered by agriculture, he'd have found the close-knit social world for which he yearned. The sense of being alone, even in a crowded city, is an oddity in human life, included, like so much else, in the agricultural package. Looking back from his overcrowded world, Thomas Hobbes imagined that prehistoric human life was unbearably solitary. Today, separated from countless strangers by only thin walls, tiny earphones, and hectic schedules, we assume a desolate sense of isolation must have weighed on our ancestors, wandering over their windswept prehistoric landscape. But in fact, this seemingly common-sense assumption couldn't be more mistaken. The social lives of foragers are characterized by a depth and intensity of interaction few of us could imagine or tolerate. For those of us born and raised in societies organized around the interlocking principles of individuality, personal space, and private property, it's difficult to project our imaginations into those tightly woven societies where almost all space and property is communal, and identity is more collective than individual. From the first morning of birth to the final morning of death, a forager's life is one of intense, constant interaction, interrelation, and interdependence. In this section, we'll examine the first element in Hobbes's famous dictum about prehistoric human life. We'll show that before the rise of the state, prehistoric human life was far from solitary. Chapter 6. Who's Your Daddies?
In view of the frequent occurrence of modern domestic groups that do not consist of or contain an exclusive pair-bonded father and mother, I cannot see why anyone should insist that our ancestors were reared in monogamous nuclear families and that pair-bonding is more natural than other arrangements. Marvin Harris.
The birds and the bees are different in the Amazon. There, a woman not only can be a little pregnant, most are. Each of the societies we're about to discuss shares a belief in what scientists call partial paternity. These groups have a novel conception of conception. A fetus is made of accumulated semen. Anthropologists Stephen Beckerman and Paul Valentine explain, pregnancy is viewed as a matter of degree, not clearly distinguished from gestation. All sexually active women are a little pregnant. Over time, semen accumulates in the womb, a fetus is formed, further acts of intercourse follow, and additional semen causes the fetus to grow more. Were a woman to stop having sex when her period stopped, people in these cultures believe the fetus would stop developing. This understanding of how semen forms a child leads to some mighty interesting conclusions regarding responsible sexual behavior. Like mothers everywhere, a woman from these societies is eager to give her child every possible advantage in life. To this end, she'll typically seek out sex with an assortment of men. She'll solicit contributions from the best hunters, the best storytellers, the funniest, the kindest, the best looking, the strongest, and so on, in the hopes her child will literally absorb the essence of each. Anthropologists report similar understandings of conception and fetal development among many South American societies, ranging from simple hunter-gatherers to horticulturalists. A partial list would include the Aché, the Arawete, the Bari, the Canela, the Kashinahua, the Curipaco, the Eseeja, the Kayapo, the Kulina, the Matisse, the Mehinaku, the Piaroa, the Piraha, the Sequoia, the Siona, the Warao, the Yanomami, and the Yaquana, societies from Venezuela to Bolivia. This is no ethnographic curiosity either, a strange idea being passed among related cultures. The same understanding is found among cultural groups that show no evidence of contact for millennia. Nor is portable paternity limited to South America. For example, the Lusi of Papua New Guinea also hold that fetal development depends on multiple acts of intercourse, often with different men. Even today, the younger Lusi, who have some sense of the modern understanding of reproduction, agree that a person can have more than one father. As Beckerman and Valentine explain, it is difficult to come to any conclusion except that partible paternity is an ancient folk belief capable of supporting effective families, families that provide satisfactory paternal care of children and manage the successful rearing of children to adulthood. When an anthropologist working in Paraguay asked his Aché subjects to identify their fathers, he was presented with a mathematical puzzle that could be solved only with a vocabulary lesson. The 321 Aché claimed to have over 600 fathers. Who's your daddies? It turns out the Aché distinguish four different kinds of fathers. According to the anthropologist Kim Hill, the four types of fathers are Miare, the father who put it in, Peruare, the fathers who mixed it, Momboare, those who spilled it out, and Biquare, the fathers who provided the child's essence. Rather than being shunned as bastards or sons of bitches, children of multiple fathers benefit from having more than one man who takes a special interest in them. Anthropologists have calculated that their chances of surviving childhood are often significantly better than those of children in the same societies with just one recognized father. Far from being enraged at having his genetic legacy called into question, a man in these societies is likely to feel gratitude to other men for pitching in to help create and then care for a stronger baby. Far from being blinded by jealousy, as the standard narrative predicts, men in these societies find themselves bound to one another by shared paternity for the children they've fathered together. As Beckerman explains, in the worst-case scenario, this system may provide extra security for the child. You know that if you die, there's some other man who has a residual obligation to care for at least one of your children. So looking the other way, or even giving your blessing when your wife takes a lover, is the only insurance you can buy. Lest any readers feel tempted to file this sort of behavior under BAD, bizarre and distant, similar examples can be found quite close to home.
The joy of EX. Understanding is a lot like sex. It's got a practical purpose, but that's not why people do it normally. Frank Oppenheimer.
Desmond Morris spent months observing a British pro soccer team in the late 1970s and early 1980s, later publishing his thoughts in a book called The Soccer Tribe. As his title suggests, Morris found the behavior of the teammates to be strikingly similar to what he'd encountered among tribal groups in previous research. He noted two behaviors particularly salient in both contexts, group leveling and non-possessiveness. The first thing you notice when footballers talk among themselves, Morris wrote, is the speed of their wit. Their humor is often cruel and is used to deflate any teammate who shows the slightest signs of egotism. But echoes of prehistoric egalitarianism reverberate beyond ego deflation in the locker room, extending to sexuality as well. If one of them scores, sexually, he is not possessive, but is only too happy to see his teammate succeed with the same girl. While this may strike some as unfeeling, Morris assured his readers that this lack of jealousy was simply a measure of the extent to which selfishness is suppressed between teammates, both on the field and off it. For professional athletes, musicians, and their most enthusiastic female fans, as well as both male and female members of many foraging societies, overlapping intersecting sexual relationships strengthen group cohesion and can offer a measure of security in an uncertain world. Sometimes, perhaps most of the time, human sex isn't just about pleasure or reproduction. A casual approach to sexual relationships in a community of adults can have important social functions, extending far beyond mere physical gratification. Let's try putting this liquid libido into dry academic terms. We hypothesize that socioerotic exchanges, SEX for short, strengthen the bonds among individuals in small-scale nomadic societies and apparently other highly interdependent groups, forming a crucial, durable web of affection, affiliation, and mutual obligation. In evolutionary terms, it would be hard to overstate the importance of such networks. After all, it was primarily such flexible, adaptive social groups and the feedback loop of brain growth and language capacities that both allowed and resulted from them that enabled our slow, weak, generally unimpressive species to survive and eventually dominate the entire planet. Without frequent SEX, it's doubtful that foraging bands could have maintained social equilibrium and fecundity over the millennia. SEX were crucial in binding adults into groups that cared communally for children of obscure or shared paternity, each child likely related to most or all of the men in the group, if not a father, certainly an uncle, cousin. In A Personal Communication, Don Pollock makes an interesting point about the notion of multiple fatherhood, writing, I have always found the Kulina notion that more than one man may be a biological father to a child to be, ironically, similar to the genetic reality. In a small, genetically homogeneous population, or close to it after many generations of inmarrying, every child has close genetic similarities to all of the men with whom his or her mother had sexual relations, even to those the mother was not involved with. Because these interlocking relationships are so crucial to social cohesion, opting out can cause problems. Writing of the Matisse people, anthropologist Philippe Erickson confirms, plural paternity is more than a theoretical possibility. Extramarital sex is not only widely practiced and usually tolerated, in many respects, it also appears mandatory. Married or not, one has a moral duty to respond to the sexual advances of opposite-sex cross-cousins, real or classificatory, under pains of being labeled stingy of one's genitals, a breach of Matisse ethics far more serious than plain infidelity. Being labeled a sexual cheapskate is no laughing matter, apparently. Erickson writes of one young man who cowered in the anthropologist's hut for hours, hiding from his horny cousin, whose advances he couldn't legitimately reject if she tracked him down. Even more serious, during Matisse tattooing festivals, having sex with one's customary partners is expressly forbidden, under threat of extreme punishment, even death. But if it's true that SEX played a central role in maintaining prehistoric social cohesion, we should find remnants of such shamelessly libidinous behavior throughout the world, past and present. We do. Among the Mojave, women were famous for their licentious habits and disinclination to stick with one man. Caesar, yes, that Caesar, was scandalized to note that in Iron Age Britain, 10 and even 12 have wives common to them, and particularly brothers among brothers. During his 3 months in Tahiti in 1769, Captain James Cook and his crew found that Tahitians gratified every appetite and passion before witnesses. In an account of Cook's voyage first published in 1773, John Hawkesworth wrote of a young man, nearly 6 feet high, performing the rites of Venus with a little girl about 11 or 12 years of age before several of our people and a great number of natives, without the least sense of its being indecent or improper, but as appeared in perfect conformity to the custom of the place. Some of the older islander women, who were observing this amorous display, apparently called out instructions to the girl, although Cook tells us, young as she was, she did not seem much to stand in need of them. Samuel Wallace, another ship captain who spent time in Tahiti, reported, "The women in general are very handsome, some really great beauties, yet their virtue was not proof against a nail." The Tahitians' fascination with iron resulted in a de facto exchange of a single nail for a sexual tryst with a local woman. By the time Wallace set sail, most of his men were sleeping on deck, as there were no nails left from which to hang their hammocks. There is a yam harvest festival in the present-day Trobriand Islands, in which groups of young women roam the islands raping men from outside their own village, purportedly biting off their eyebrows if the men do not satisfy them. Ancient Greece celebrated sexual license in the festivals of Aphrodisia, Dionysia, and Linnaea. In Rome, members of the cult of Bacchus hosted orgies no fewer than 5 times per month, while many islands in the South Pacific are still famous for their openness to unconstrained sexuality, despite the concerted efforts of generations of missionaries preaching the morality of shame. Many modern-day Brazilians let it all hang out during Carnival when they participate in a rite of consensual non-marital sex known as sacanagem that makes the goings-on in New Orleans or Las Vegas look tame. Though the eager participation of women in these activities may surprise some readers, it has long been clear that the sources of female sexual reticence are more cultural than biological, despite what Darwin and others have supposed. Over 50 years ago, sex researchers Cleland Ford and Frank Beach declared, "In those societies which have no double standard in sexual matters, and in which a variety of liaisons are permitted, the women avail themselves as eagerly of their opportunity as do the men." Nor do the females of our closest primate cousins offer much reason to believe the human female should be sexually reluctant due to purely biological concerns. Instead, primatologist Meredith Small has noted that female primates are highly attracted to novelty in mating. Unfamiliar males appear to attract females more than known males with any other characteristic a male might offer. High status, large size, coloration, frequent grooming, hairy chest, gold chains, pinky ring, whatever. Small writes, "The only consistent interest seen among the general primate population is an interest in novelty and variety. In fact," she reports, "the search for the unfamiliar is documented as a female preference more often than is any other characteristic our human eyes can perceive." Franz de Waal could have been referring to any of the previously mentioned Amazonian societies when he wrote that the male has no idea which copulations may result in conception and which may not. Almost any child growing up in the group could be his. If one had to design a social system in which fatherhood remained obscure, one could hardly do a better job than Mother Nature did with this society. Though de Waal's words are applicable to any of the many societies who engage in ritualized extra-pair sex, he was, in fact, writing of the bonobo, thus underscoring the sexual continuity linking the three most closely related apes, chimps, bonobos, and their conflicted human cousins. In light of the hypersexuality of humans, chimps, and bonobos, one wonders why so many insist that female sexual exclusivity has been an integral part of human evolutionary development for over 1 million years. In addition to all the direct evidence presented here, the circumstantial case against the narrative is overwhelming. For starters, recall that the total number of monogamous primate species that live in large social groups is precisely zero. Unless you insist on counting humans as the one and only example of such a beast. The few monogamous primates that do exist, out of hundreds of species, all live in the treetops. Primates aside, only 3% of mammals and 1 in 10,000 invertebrate species can be considered sexually monogamous. Adultery has been documented in every ostensibly monogamous human society ever studied and is a leading cause of divorce all over the world today. But even in the latest editions of his classic book, The Naked Ape, the same Desmond Morris who observed soccer players happily sharing their lovers still insists that, among humans, sexual behavior occurs almost exclusively in a pair-bonded state, and that adultery reflects an imperfection in the pair-bonding mechanism. That's a major, minor imperfection. As we write these words, CNN reports that 6 adulterers are being stoned to death in Iran. Before the hypocritical sinners throw the first stones, the male adulterers will be buried up to their waists. In a sickening gesture towards chivalry, the women will be buried to their necks, presumably to bring a quicker death to these women who dared consider their bodies their own. Such brutal execution of sexual transgressors is anything but an oddity, historically speaking. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism each share a fundamental concern over the punishment for a woman's sexual freedom, says Eric Michael Johnson. Whereas any man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. Leviticus 20:10. But any unmarried woman who has sexual relations with an unmarried man shall be brought to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones that she die. Deuteronomy 22:21. Yet even after centuries of such barbaric punishment, adultery persists everywhere, without exception. As Alfred Kinsey noted back in the 1950s, even in cultures which most rigorously attempt to control the female's extramarital coitus, it is perfectly clear that such activity does occur, and in many instances, it occurs with considerable regularity. Think about that. No group-living non-human primate is monogamous, and adultery has been documented in every human culture studied, including those in which fornicators are routinely stoned to death. In light of all this bloody retribution, it's hard to see how monogamy comes naturally to our species. Why would so many risk their reputations, families, careers, even presidential legacies, for something that runs against human nature? Were monogamy an ancient evolved trait characteristic of our species, as the standard narrative insists, these ubiquitous transgressions would be infrequent and such horrible enforcement unnecessary. No creature needs to be threatened with death to act in accord with its own nature.
The promise of promiscuity. Modern men and women are obsessed with the sexual. It is the only realm of primordial adventure still left to most of us. Like apes in a zoo, we spend our energies on the one field of play remaining. Human lives otherwise are pretty well caged in by the walls, bars, chains, and locked gates of our industrial culture. Edward Abbey.
As we consider alternate views of prehistoric human sexuality, keep in mind that the core logic of the standard narrative pivots on 2 interlocking assumptions. A prehistoric mother and child needed the meat and protection a man would provide. A woman would have had to offer her own sexual autonomy in exchange, thus assuring him that it was his child he was supporting. The standard narrative is founded upon the belief that the exchange of protein and protection for assured paternity was the best way to increase the odds of a child's survival to reproductive age. Survival of offspring is, after all, the primary engine of natural selection, as described by Darwin and subsequent theorists. But what if risk to offspring were mitigated more effectively by behavior that encouraged the opposite arrangement? What if, rather than one man agreeing to share his meat, protection, and status with a particular woman and her child, sharing were generalized? What if group-wide sharing offered a more effective approach to the risks our ancestors encountered in the prehistoric world? And in light of these risks, what if paternity uncertainty were more beneficial to the child's chances of survival as more men would take an interest in him or her? Again, we're not suggesting a nobler social system, just one that might have been better suited to meeting the challenges of prehistoric conditions and more effective in helping people survive long enough to reproduce. This sharing-based social life is far from uniquely human. For example, vampire bats in Central America feed on the blood of large mammals. But not every bat finds a meal each night. When they return to their dens, those bats who have had a good night regurgitate blood into the mouths of bats who have not had as much luck. Recipients of such largesse are likely to return the favor when the conditions have reversed themselves, but are less likely to give blood to bats who have denied them in the past. As one reviewer put it, the key to this bit-for-bat process is the individual bat's ability to remember the history of its relationships with all other bats living in its den. This mnemonic requirement has driven the evolution of vampire bat brains, which possess the largest neocortex of all known bat species. We hope the thought of vampire bats coughing down blood for their non-blood relatives is graphic enough to convince you that sharing isn't innately noble. Some species, in some conditions, have simply found that generosity is the best way to reduce risk in an uncertain ecological context. Homo sapiens appears to have been such a species until relatively recent times. The near universality of fierce egalitarianism among foragers suggests there was really little choice for our prehistoric ancestors. Archaeologist Peter Bagucki writes, "For Ice Age mobile hunting societies, the band model of social organization, with its obligatory sharing of resources, was really the only way to live. It makes perfect Darwinian sense to suppose that prehistoric humans would choose the path that offered the best chance of survival, even if that path required egalitarian sharing of resources, rather than the self-interested hoarding of resources many contemporary Western societies insist is basic human nature. After all, Darwin himself believed a tribe of cooperative people would vanquish one composed of selfish individualists. Are we preaching far-fetched flower power silliness? Hardly. Egalitarianism is found in nearly all simple hunter-gatherer societies that have been studied anywhere in the world. Groups facing conditions most similar to those our ancestors confronted 50,000 or 100,000 years ago. They've followed an egalitarian path not because they are particularly noble, but because it offers them the best chance of survival. Indeed, under these conditions, egalitarianism may be the only way to live, as Bagucki concluded. Institutionalized sharing of resources and sexuality spreads and minimizes risk, assures food won't be wasted in a world without refrigeration, eliminates the effects of male infertility, promotes the genetic health of individuals, and assures a more secure social environment for children and adults alike. Far from utopian romanticism, foragers insist on egalitarianism because it works on the most practical levels. Bonobo beginnings. The effectiveness of sexual egalitarianism is confirmed by female bonobos, who share many otherwise unique traits with humans and no other species. These sexual characteristics have direct, predictable social consequences. DeWall's research has demonstrated, for example, that the increased sexual receptivity of the female bonobo dramatically reduces male conflict when compared with other primates whose females are significantly less sexually available. The abundance of sexual opportunity makes it less worthwhile for males to risk injury by fighting over any particular sexual opportunity. Since alliances among male chimps, for example, generally serve to keep competitors away from an ovulating female, or to attain the high status that brings more mating opportunities to a given male, the principal motivation for these unruly gangs evaporates in the relaxing heat of bonobos' plentiful sexual opportunity. These same dynamics apply to human groups. Aside from the social habits of man as he now exists, why presume the monogamous, pair-based model of human evolution currently favored would have been adaptive for early humans, but not for bonobos in the jungles of Central Africa? Unconstrained by cultural restrictions, the so-called continual responsiveness of the human female would fulfill the same function, provide plentiful sexual opportunity for males, thereby reducing conflict and allowing larger group sizes, more extensive cooperation, and greater security for all. As anthropologist Chris Knight puts it, whereas the basic primate pattern is to deliver a periodic yes signal against a background of continuous sexual no, humans and bonobos emit a periodic no signal against a background of continuous yes. Here we have the same behavioral and physiological adaptation unique to two very closely related primates, yet many theorists insist the adaptation must have completely different origins and functions in each. This increased social cohesion is, in fact, probably the most common explanation for the potent combination of extended receptivity and hidden ovulation found only in humans and bonobos. But most scientists seem to see only half of this logical connection, as in this abstract. Females who concealed ovulation were favored because the group in which they lived maintained a peaceful stability that facilitated monogamy, sharing, and cooperation. It's clear how greater female sexual availability could increase sharing, cooperation, and peaceful stability, but why monogamy should be added to the list is a question that not only goes unanswered, but is almost never asked. Those anthropologists willing to acknowledge the realities of human sexuality see its social benefits clearly. Beckerman and Ballantyne point to the fact that partible paternity diffuses potential conflicts between men, noting that such antagonisms tend to be unhelpful to a woman's long-term reproductive interests. Anthropologist Thomas Greger reported 88 ongoing affairs among the 37 adults in the Mehinaku village he studied in Brazil. In his opinion, extramarital relationships contribute to village cohesion by consolidating relationships between persons of different clans and promoting enduring relationships based on mutual affection. He found that many lovers are very fond of one another and regard separation as a privation to avoid. Rather than risk overwhelming you with dozens more examples of this community-building, conflict-reducing human sexuality, we'll conclude with just one more. Anthropologists William and Jean Crocker visited and studied the Canela people, also of the Brazilian Amazon region, for more than three decades, beginning in the late 1950s. They explain, "It is difficult for members of a modern individualistic society to imagine the extent to which the Canela saw the group and the tribe as more important than the individual. Generosity and sharing was the ideal, while withholding was a social evil. Sharing possessions brought esteem. Sharing one's body was a direct corollary. Desiring control over one's goods and self was a form of stinginess. In this context, it is easy to understand why women chose to please men and why men chose to please women who expressed strong sexual needs. No one was so self-important that satisfying a fellow tribesman was less gratifying than personal gain." Recognized as a way to build and maintain a network of mutually beneficial relationships, non-reproductive sex no longer requires special explanations. Homosexuality, for example, becomes far less confusing in that it is, as E.O. Wilson has written, above all, a form of bonding consistent with the greater part of heterosexual behavior as a device that cements relationships. Paternity certainty, far from being the universal and overriding obsession of all men everywhere and always, as the standard narrative insists, was likely a non-issue to men who lived before agriculture and resulting concerns with passing property through lines of paternal descent. Chapter 7. Mommy's Dearest.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. Khalil Gibran.
The diffused sense of parental responsibility resulting from these intersecting webs of sexual interaction extends to mothers as well as fathers. Anthropologist Donald Pollack tells us that while the Kulina believe the fetus to have originally been formed of accumulated semen, men's milk in Kulina, they attribute the baby's growth after birth to women's milk. Any number of women might nurse the child, he writes. It is particularly common for a group of sisters to share nursing functions. It is not unknown for the mother's mother to allow an infant to nurse, even if the grandmother is no longer lactating, to quiet a crying child whose mother is occupied. When he asked whether these other women were also mothers of the child, Pollack was told this was obviously so. Recalling his childhood among the Dagara in Burkina Faso, author and psychologist Malidoma Patrice Somme remembers how freely children wandered into houses throughout the village. Somme explains that this gives the child a very broad sense of belonging, and that everybody chips in to help raise the child. Apart from the many obvious benefits to parents, Somme sees distinct psychological advantages for the children, saying, "It's very rare that a child feels isolated or develops psychological problems. Everyone is very aware of where he or she belongs." Though Somme's account may sound like idealized memory, what he describes is still standard village life in most of rural Africa, where children are welcome to wander in and out of the homes of unrelated adults in villages. Though a mother's love is no doubt unique, women, and some men the world over, are eager to coo over unrelated babies, not just their own, an eagerness common to other social primates, none of whom, by the way, are monogamous. This deeply felt, broadly shared willingness to care for unrelated children lives on in the modern world. The bureaucratic ordeal of adoption rivals or exceeds the stress and expense of childbirth, yet millions of couples eagerly pursue its uncertain rewards. Scientists focused only on the nuclear family miss the central role of alloparenting in our species, where non-parents act in a parental role. Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy, author of Mothers and Others, laments, "Infant sharing in other primates and in various tribal societies has never been accorded center stage in the anthropological literature. Many people don't even realize it goes on. Yet the consequences of cooperative care, in terms of survival and biological fitness of mother and infant, turn out to be all to the good." Darwin entertained the radical possibility that the mother-child bond may have been less important to barbarous individuals than their bond with the greater group. Commenting on the customary use of familial terms like mother, father, son, and daughter in reference to all group members, he suggested, "The terms employed express a connection with the tribe alone to the exclusion of the mother. It seems possible that the connection between the related members of the same barbarous tribe, exposed to all sorts of danger, might be so much more important, owing to the need of mutual protection and aid, than that between the mother and her child." When 17th-century Jesuit missionary Paul Lejeune lectured a Montagne Indian man about the dangers of the rampant infidelity he'd witnessed, Lejeune received a lesson on proper parenthood in response. The missionary recalled, "I told him that it was not honorable for a woman to love anyone else except her husband, and that this evil being among them, he himself was not sure that his son, who was there present, was his son. He replied, 'Thou hast no sense. You French people love only your own children, but we all love all the children of our tribe.'" Though it seems like common sense to most of us, our own biology-based kinship system is another case of Flintstonization. We simply assume our own conception of family reflects something eternal and universal in human nature. But as we've seen, there isn't even agreement among all people that one sex act is sufficient to result in pregnancy. The concept of one mother per child is running into trouble in Western societies, too. Motherhood is splintering, writes William Salatin, the human nature expert at Slate.com. You can have a genetic mother, a gestational mother, an adoptive mother, and God knows what else. When one of your moms is grandma, it's even more confusing. Speaking of surrogate mothers who gestate another woman's fetus, Salatin argues that it makes sense for a woman's mother to offer to carry the baby. When the surrogate is grandma, the mess is less. Mother and daughter share a genetic bond to each other and to the child. They're much more likely to work things out and give the child a stable family environment. Perhaps. Either way, with widespread adoption, stepfamilies resulting from remarriage, and techniques such as surrogate gestation, sperm donation, and cryogenic embryo preservation, Homo sapiens is on the fast track away from traditional family structures, perhaps headed toward more flexible arrangements reminiscent of the distant past. Belief in partible paternity spreads fatherly feelings throughout a group, but this is just one of many mechanisms for enhancing group solidity. Anthropologists report numerous societies in which naming ceremonies and clan affiliations create obligations between individuals more binding than blood relations. Referring to the Matis people, with whom he lived, anthropologist Philippe Erickson notes, "When it comes to defining kinship ties, relationships deriving from naming practices have absolute priority over any other considerations, such as genealogical connections. When conflicts arise between the two modes of reckoning, sharing a name has precedence." Some anthropologists question whether kinship is an important concept in band-level societies at all, however defined. They argue that since everyone in such a small-scale society is likely to be related to each other in some way, affinity tends to be measured in more fluid terms, such as friendship and sharing partners. As Darwin understood, even the most direct and immediate kinship terminology is subject to cultural definition. Fatherly behavior is expected of all the males of a local clan toward all the young of the clan, says anthropologist Janet Chernella. Multiple aspects of caretaking, including affection and food getting, are provided by all clansmen. Anthropologist Vanessa Leah notes that, based upon her experience among the Meben Gokre, the allocation of responsibility is socially constructed and not an objective fact. Among the Tukanoan, clan brothers provide for one another's children as a collective. Through the pooling of the daily catch, each male regularly labors for all of the children of a village, his own offspring as well as those of his brothers. This diffused approach to parenting isn't limited to villages in Africa or Amazonia. Desmond Morris recalls an afternoon he spent with a female truck driver in Polynesia. She told him that she'd had 9 children, but had given 2 of them to an infertile friend. When Morris asked how the kids felt about that, she said they didn't mind at all, as all of us love all of the children. Morris recalls, "This last point is underlined by the fact that, when we reach the village, she passes the time by wandering over to a group of toddlers, lying down in the grass with them and playing with them exactly as if they were her own. They accept her instantly, without any questioning, and a passerby would never have guessed that they were anything other than a natural family playing together." A natural family. Perhaps this easy acceptance between adults and unrelated children, the diffuse nurturing found in societies where children refer to all men as father and all women as mother, societies small and isolated enough to safely assume the kindness of strangers, where overlapping sexual relationships leave genetic paternity unknowable and of little consequence, perhaps this is the natural family structure of our species. Could it be that the atomic isolation of the husband-wife nucleus with an orbiting child or two is in fact a culturally imposed aberration for our species, as ill-suited to our evolved tendencies as corsets, chastity belts, and suits of armor? Dare we ask whether mothers, fathers, and children are all being shoehorned into a family structure that suits none of us? Might the contemporary pandemics of fracturing families, parental exhaustion, and confused, resentful children be predictable consequences of what is, in truth, a distorted and distorting family structure inappropriate for our species? Nuclear meltdown. If the independent, isolated nuclear family unit is in fact the structure into which human beings most naturally configure themselves, why do contemporary societies and religions find it necessary to prop it up with tax breaks and supportive legislature while fiercely defending it from same-sex couples and others proposing to marry in supposedly non-traditional ways? One wonders, in fact, why marriage is a legal issue at all, apart from its relevance to immigration and property laws. Why would something so integral to human nature require such vigilant legal protection? Furthermore, if the nuclear triad is so deeply embedded in our nature, why are fewer and fewer of us choosing to live that way? In the United States, the percentage of nuclear family households has dropped from 45 to 23.5 since the 1970s. Married couples, with and without children, accounted for roughly 84% of all American households in 1930, but the latest figure is just under 50%, while the number of unmarried couples living together has mushroomed from about 500,000 in 1970 to more than 10 times that number in 2008. Before Bronislaw Malinowski, 1884 to 1942, the most respected and influential anthropologist of his day, declared the issue settled, there was plenty of debate over whether or not the mother-father-child triad was in fact the universal atomic unit of human social organization. Malinowski scoffed at Morgan's notion that societies could ever have been organized along non-nuclear lines, writing, "These actors are obviously three in number at the beginning, the two parents and their offspring. This unquestionably correct principle has become the starting point for a new interpretation of Morgan's hypothesis of a primitive communal marriage. They are fully aware that group marriage implies group parenthood, yet group parenthood is an almost unthinkable hypothesis. This conclusion has led to such capital howlers as that the clan marries the clan and begets the clan, and that the clan, like the family, is a reproductive group." Unquestioningly correct principle? Unthinkable hypothesis? Capital howlers? Malinowski seems to have been personally offended that Morgan had dared to doubt the universality and naturalness of the sanctified nuclear family structure. Meanwhile, within a few blocks of the London classrooms where he lectured, untold numbers of infants whose existence threatened to expose the colossal error at the heart of Malinowski's unquestioningly correct principle were being sacrificed quite literally in foundling hospitals. The situation was no less horrific in the United States. In 1915, a doctor named Henry Chapin visited 10 foundling hospitals and found that in 9 of them, every child died before the age of 2. Every child. This dark fate awaited inconvenient children born throughout Europe. In her memoir of middle-class life in early 20th century Germany, for instance, Doris Drucker describes the village Angel Maker, who received babies from unwed mothers and starved the little children in her care to death, while the unwed, now childless mother was hired out as a wet nurse to upper-class families. How efficient. Horrifying as it is to contemplate, widespread infanticide was not limited to Malinowski's day. For centuries, millions of European children had been passed through discreet revolving boxes set into the walls of foundling hospitals. These boxes were designed to protect the anonymity of the person leaving the child, but they offered scant protection to the infant. The survival rate in those institutions was little better than if the revolving boxes had opened directly into a crematorium's furnace. Far from being places of healing, these were government and church-approved slaughterhouses where children whose existence might have raised inconvenient questions about the naturalness of the nuclear family were disposed of in a form of industrialized infanticide. In his book Eve's Seed, Biology, the Sexes, and the Course of History, historian Robert S. McIlvaine gets off a few capital howlers of his own, writing, "The general trend in human evolution is undeniably toward pair bonding and lasting families. Pair bonding, albeit often with some backsliding, especially by men, and the family are, he insists, the exceptions notwithstanding, among the traits that characterize the human species. Sure, forget all the backsliding and the many exceptions, and you've got a real strong case." Despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, Malinowski's position remains deeply embedded in both scientific and popular assumptions about family structure. In fact, the whole architecture of what qualifies as family in Western society is based on Malinowski's insistence that each child everywhere has always had just one father. But if Malinowski's position has won the day, why is poor Morgan's intellectual body still being regularly disinterred for further insult? Anthropologist Laura Betzig opens a paper on conjugal dissolution, failed marriage, by noting that Morgan's fantasy of group marriage expired on encountering the evidence, and a century after Morgan, the consensus is that monogamous marriage comes as close to being a human universal as anything about human behavior can. Ouch. But in truth, Morgan's understanding of family structure was no fantasy. His conclusions were based upon decades of extensive field research and study. Later, a bit less wind in her sails, Betzig admits that there is still, however, no consensus as to why marriage is so widespread. That's a mystery, all right. We'll see that anthropologists find marriage wherever they look, mainly because they haven't quite decided what it looks like. Chapter 8. Making a Mess of Marriage, Mating, and Monogamy.
Marriage is the most natural state of man, and therefore the state in which you are most likely to find solid happiness. Benjamin Franklin. Love is an ideal thing. Marriage, a real thing. A confusion of the real with the ideal never goes unpunished. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe.
When Albert Einstein proclaimed that E equals mc squared, no physicists asked each other, "What's he mean by E?" In the hard sciences, the important stuff comes packaged in numbers and predefined symbols. Imprecise wording rarely causes confusion. But in more interpretive sciences, such as anthropology, psychology, and evolutionary theory, misinterpretation and misunderstanding are common. Take the words love and lust, for example. Love and lust are as different from each other as red wine and blue cheese, but because they can also complement one another splendidly, they get conflated with amazing, dumbfounding regularity. In the literature of evolutionary psychology, in popular culture, in the tastefully appointed offices of marriage counselors, in religious teachings, in political discourse, and in our own mixed-up lives, lust is often mistaken for love. Perhaps even more insidious and damaging in societies insistent on long-term, sexually exclusive monogamy, the negative form of that statement is also true. The absence of lust is misread as indicating an absence of love. We'll explore this in Part 5. Experts inadvertently encourage us to confuse the two. Helen Fisher's Anatomy of Love, a book referenced earlier, is far more concerned with shared parental responsibility for a child's first few years than with the love joining the parents to one another. But we can't blame Fisher, as the language itself works against clarity. We can sleep with someone without ever closing our eyes. When we read that the politician made love with the prostitute, we know that love had little to do with it. When we report how many lovers we've had, are we claiming to have been in love with all of them? Similarly, if we mate with someone, does that make us mates? Show a guy a photo of a hot-looking woman and ask him if he'd like to mate with her. chances are good he'll say, or think, sure. But chances are also high that marriage, children, and the prospect of a long future together never entered into his decision-making process. Everyone knows these are arbitrary expressions for an almost infinite range of situations and